Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My next guest compares the time we're living in right now to the day before the Renaissance, which sounds like a good thing, but he also says the only way we can avoid calamity is by asking the right questions. Here with me now to ask and maybe answer some of these questions is David Rothkopf, CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, a visiting professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and author of the new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Thanks so much for coming in. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's a pleasure to be back.
And so the questions you pose and explore in your book are all so huge, it's hard to know where to start. So let me ask you a meta question. Why ask who are we or who rules us at this particular time? Questions that foundational.
Well, every once in a while in history, not even every 100 years, but perhaps every 300, 400, or 500 years, we reach a watershed where technology and social advances outstrip the ability of institutions or belief systems to keep up with them. And this really causes deep-seated disruption and a lot of work for philosophers. The bigger the changes, the more fundamental the questions we've got to ask. And so, you know, go back to the Reformation or the Renaissance, and all of a sudden we were going from principalities to nation states. We were going from churches that were ruled in Rome to churches that were ruled within the state. There was the rise of the middle class. There were new concepts about the international community, about war, about individual rights. And there was the printing press, you know, which 350 years later produced our conclusions about free press. And so I think we're at one of those moments. The problem is we've spent the past couple of decades focusing on urgent problems that were not as important as the impending changes.
What you call lagging indicators, which is where you think our politics is stuck.
Right. I think government is historically a lagging indicator. It tends to be behind the curve, even on sort of the near-term issues, quarterly and annual kind of issues. But when it comes to the big issues, like should you have a right to the internet, or what's the nature of warfare in the world of cool war and cyber war, or where do we go from here when our old economics doesn't in any way begin to cover the new kind of economy we're in, government's clueless.
Let me get you to jump in on one of those that you just mentioned. Your chapter six is the question, what is war? What is peace? Power, conflict, and stability reimagined. Do we not know what war is anymore?
I don't think we do. You know, I think there's a traditional view of things blowing up and people dying and armies engaging each other. But I think we're into a new era. You know, during the Cold War, the price of international conflict was so high, nobody dared enter into it. But now in this period, which I would call Cool War, the price of international conflict is so low that no one dares stop. And by that, I mean cyber conflict, the kind of conflict where we could wage a war against 100 nations simultaneously, not with the goal of destroying them, but with the goal of slowing them down or impeding their institutions. We don't have a doctrine to go with that. When the North Koreans attacked Sony, literally blew up computers, if they'd done that with a small band of guys who got out of a rubber boat in L.A., we'd say, okay, well, we go and attack them back. But they did it via cyber, and the president of the United States said, well, that's vandalism. He was searching for a word that wouldn't require him to go back in and attack them.
And just to be clear, your phrase, cool war, that doesn't mean that war is cool in somebody's eyes. You're talking about as compared to hot war.
Right. I'm not assuming, you know, when you talk to a WNYC listener, cool means something completely different.
Absolutely,
of course, right.
Especially in Brooklyn.
Especially in Brooklyn, right. But where both my daughters are at the moment being very cool. But essentially what I mean here is war that's not hot and that's not cold, that's in that nether zone, and we don't have the doctrines to deal with it. We don't even have leaders who understand the terminology to have an informed conversation about it.
Another one, you don't just talk about inequality in the book. You ask, What is Money? Economics Work and Markets Reimagined is the subtitle of that chapter. Why do you ask, what is money? Do we no longer know for sure what money is?
Well, I ask it on several levels. One level is that I don't think, you know, our grandchildren will actually hold money in their hands. It's bits and bytes. It's electronic. On another hand, I think that the tools of economics that we once ascribed to the most powerful people in the world. Alan Greenspan was always called the most powerful man in the world. And essentially, he had two tools. He had a monetary tool and a fiscal tool. But we're moving into an age where big data is going to give governments real-time information on very granular levels on society. And we may move from macroeconomics to nanoeconomics, where you come up with a stimulus for a tiny group of people. You know, right now, when we talk about economics, we're talking about the U.S., because that was the chunk we had, right? But we could imagine a state using digital, you know, big data called Lehrerstan. And Lehrerstan might be 10 million people who did more or less just what you did, and we could come up with new stimuli that would work for you that wouldn't work for Rothkopfstan, which would be a small, impoverished country.
Certainly, Lehrerstan would be a utopia.
Yes,
but,
exactly.
But then we get the very – it's funny because in Washington now they're talking about how to simplify the tax code. And in the last election, you know, there's always people saying, oh, we should be able to fill out our taxes with one rate on the back of a postcard. The world you're imagining – with the way that small groups of people can be micro-targeted as they are now for advertising and things like that, government stimulus policies, the tax code could become even that much more complicated, and maybe it would be a good thing.
Well, and could be much less visible. It could be more progressive. You know, in Oregon right now, they're experimenting with a system for paying for highways where the people use the highways more are taxed a little more. And the way we know who uses the highways more is GPS. And the GPS says, well, they're on the road. Let's charge them a little bit, micro increments as they go. Well, everybody is going to literally have multiple sensors on them and in their wallets and in their credit cards all the time. And if you pick up one kind of thing, you might get taxed on it. And furthermore, you know, that there's the flip side. You know, every institution that's gone through technological change has seen disintermediation except government. We've now got millions of people in the government who could easily be replaced by algorithms. And the data we've got shows some remarkable things. Like, for example, if you really want to help a poor person, you can give them money, directly give them money. Don't give them a government program. And so you could imagine an algorithm that would take a little money out of your pocket every time you bought some cigarettes that would send that money into the pocket of somebody else who needed it, and you wouldn't need a big, giant government bureaucracy, which would cut down the cost, which would cut down the reason to tax you so much.
David Rothkopf is with us, editor and CEO of Foreign Policy Magazine and author of the new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow, which, by the way, if you think that based on that title, this is going to be like a huge doorstop, 1,000-page book like The History of the World. It's actually 110 pages and in a small frame, and you can practically read it on the A train if you're going from Upper Manhattan to Queens. The Great Questions of Tomorrow, David Rothkopf.
It was designed for a long summer.
And if you'd like to talk to David Rothkopf, we can take a few phone calls on some of the big ideas that he's already laid out, 212-433. WNYC 433-9692. And here's a question that's already come in via Twitter on the money question. Listener asks, please ask your speaker if he has an idea of our path from here to universal basic income. Well, I guess first we have to ask if that's a path you think we should be on.
Well, I think it's a path that almost inevitably we will be on, I think to some extent, because, you know, we've seen changes even over the past couple of hundred years in what a job is and the nature of work. You know, I'm sure you remember Downton Abbey, and there was a great scene where Maggie Smith was talking to somebody about the weekend, and she's like, weekend? What's weekend? You know, that's my Maggie Smith impression. But the idea was the weekend didn't exist a century ago. And we went to the 5-day work week. Well, now with automation and artificial intelligence, a lot of experts think we're going to move towards the 3-day work week, the 2-day work week, less work for everybody, And the consequence of that will be, well, how will people make their income? You know, there's a flip side. There's a philosophical question. I sometimes will talk about this in a crowd and people will go, well, this is terrible news because we get our identity from our jobs. And I'm like, you still believe that stuff? You know, this has been peddled for a long time by the people who want you to work at your job. But in this new environment, you could actually sit around all day listening to your show or paint a picture or study philosophy.
Right. But it's not out of a philosophy of everybody's lives. Everybody should be able to choose a life of leisure. It's that there's a sort of privileged professional class that gets to go into the field that they're interested in because they're interested in it. Everybody else works at jobs that to varying degrees they would rather be on the weekend. And if we head in the direction that we're heading in, where the marketplace concentrates wealth more and more in a few hands, then the only solution to that is the guaranteed income. Am I in the right direction?
No, I think that's the right direction. I think, you know, that the reality is that if you've got technology and capital right now, you're going to be able to produce a lot more and make a lot more money, and other people are going to be out of luck. And we are going to face a social crisis as a consequence of that. And one of the almost inevitable consequences, and they're already experimenting this with in countries like Finland and elsewhere, we're going to have to say, well, look, let's guarantee everybody a minimum basic income. And we'll be able to do that in a way that people won't squeal as loud because a lot of the work and a lot of the benefits are going to corporations and machines as opposed to, you know, individual people who are going to be cut out of the loop.
We'll take a break, and we'll take some of the many phone calls that are now coming in for David Rothkopf in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with David Rothkopf, editor of Foreign Policy magazine and author of the new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Here is hopefully a great question of right now from Holly in Manhattan. Holly, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. I have an idea that when you started this interview with Mr. Rothkopf, you talked about the day before the Renaissance. And I think that what's happened since the Victorian era is that words being so important, certain words have lost their meaning completely, like the word verity, truth. And now that we're living in this post-truth age, it should be understood that the word verity morphed into the word value. And that became a subjective concept that mine are different from yours. And that's the new normal. Until we find a truth again, a verity, and get that word back into our lexicon, I don't think there's much hope. And as far as I can see, civilizations die at about 400 years. And if we don't find some unity with our vocabulary and start using words that mean something, we're really going nowhere.
How much do you agree?
Well, how could I disagree? I mean, I think, you know, the reality is, of course, people can wage a war against truth, but in the end, truth wins because truth is truth. It's there, and it's either going to be acknowledged by us or we're going to try to look away from it or pretend that it's not there. And it will ultimately drive outcomes in a way that our self-delusion cannot. And I think in this particular case, one of the big truths that we have to reckon with is that if something is a big headline in the newspaper, that doesn't mean that it's urgent. That doesn't mean it's the most important thing. I have a friend who used to be a national security advisor in Washington, now unfortunately deceased, who used to say Washington is the town where the urgent always overtakes the important. And I think one of the things that we need to do is we need to say terrorism, which dominates the news, is a distraction, for example. When big changes that are coming, I'll give you the biggest change, right? Within the next 10 years, roughly, essentially every human being on the planet is going to be connected in a human-made system for the first time in history. Creates one cultural ecosystem, changes economics, politics, sense of self, sense of governance, sense of community, and so forth. We may look away from it. We may pretend it's not happening, but it's going to be here, and we're going to have to deal with it.
Robin in Westchester, you're on WNYC with David Rothkopf. Hi, Robin.
Hi, good morning. I had a question for your host. I caught the segment when he was talking about government jobs being susceptible to being replaced by technology in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck the thought saying, would it be possible to one day replace a judge by an algorithm or something along those lines?
Wow. Would that be a good thing or a bad thing in your view?
Personally, I think it would be a good thing. Because something with computers and technology is that it's unbiased. It's not influenced by, it's only influenced by facts.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Look, I don't think it's a question that we should dismiss as far-fetched. The reality is that, you know, if you talk to artificial intelligence scientists, they'll tell you 20, 30, 40, 50 years, we will achieve a level of artificial intelligence that is equivalent to human intelligence in many respects. And the question is, what do we do about that? And do we wait for that to happen before we start grappling with these questions? And, you know, there are already machines that are doing a lot of things that used to be done by people. And one could imagine a future in which a number of things that are done by judges were just as easily done by machines that could follow the letter of the law much more accurately and without coloration. Now, is that better than adding in the human judgment factor? We could argue both sides of that case.
There may not be an algorithm for compassion.
There may not. And, you know, there would be a strict constructionist that say the law is the law. Let's go this way. And there will be, you know, people who say, no, circumstances matter. We need some way to calculate that in. But here's my point. That's going to be a real question. We need to grapple with that question now rather than let things happen and react to them afterwards.
Michael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Brian. Hello, Mr. Rothkopf. I just want to start out. I'm a political science major, so Mr. Rothkopf, huge fan of foreign policy. Great job with all the additions this year.
Thank you. I'm sure you'll go very far with that attitude.
Awesome. So my question to you is, you talk about how government lags behind, and I was wondering if you have any worries about what's going to happen in the next, let's say, 10 years when automation replaces millions upon millions of jobs and the government has yet to grapple with what to do with people in terms of a universal basic income, transition of economic system. Do you worry that there could be a really destabilized period in history where we see, you know, dozens of Ted Kaczynskis start popping up?
Look, I of course I'm worried. I think that's one of the main factors that led me to write the book. And the reality is governments tend to react late. And periods like this tend to have disruptions. The move towards the Reformation, the rise of the nation state, produced the 30 Years' War, which was the bloodiest, most disruptive conflict in the history of the planet until that point. We currently have leaders who are desperately trying to turn back the clock, whether it's to the 1980s or the 1970s or the 1960s. And I include in that group Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, Bibi Netanyahu, Erdogan, et cetera, et cetera. Marine Le Pen would like to do the same thing in France. These people don't have an agenda for dealing with tomorrow's problems except to say, let's go back to the way it used to be. And we know that's not sustainable. So that's non-policy. It creates a vacuum. And what happens is these changes happen without any kind of philosophical underpinning to the way that we govern in their context. And they do produce disruptions. And I predict inequality will get worse. Tensions will grow. Not just between the top and the bottom in society, but also between cities and hinterlands. That's the divide in America right now. And we need to brace ourselves for that.
So as you point to Trump and Putin and Le Pen on the one hand, are there political leaders who you would name who sort of get this? Or at the, you know, the big macro level of even identifying the big questions of tomorrow, is this something that just basically lives in the academy and intellectual magazines like Foreign Policy at this time?
Well, very seldom we're accused of being an intellectual magazine. But I think this is a question that needs to start being asked and frankly isn't being asked that much. There's some philosophers out there who deal with Nick Bostrom is out there dealing with the philosophy of artificial intelligence through books like Superintelligence and so forth, or Andy McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson at MIT are dealing with some of the consequences of the changes in the nature of our workforce.
Or maybe it comes from the grassroots.
Well, and I think ultimately it does. But, you know, I wouldn't look to politicians first. I would say, where are the philosophers? I would say, where are the people who are grappling with these questions? You know, in the 350 years between Gutenberg and the First Amendment, we had John Locke and the Glorious Revolution and people really arguing about the role of a free press in society and so forth. And we're at one of those periods. I don't expect that, you know, we should rely on Donald Trump or the Democratic Party, or the Republican Party, or Vladimir Putin or some other party to come up with the answers to this, because it's against their self-interest to do so.
We're out of time. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, but in conjunction with the TED Talk people. Does this come from a TED Talk that you gave?
It does.
Which I guess people can see at the TED website. And you can read David Rothkopf's new book called The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here. Thank you.